physics. So, we do have the end game happening. I have posted solutions to problems at 11. I have posted a problem set 12, which you are not turning in, but it gives you problems that illustrate kinds of things that I could potentially ask about on the final for material that we've been covering since exam 3. I went ahead and posted the solutions to problem set 12 because I know we're all short of time right now, so at least you'll have those to go along as you're thinking about things. Final exam is May 6th. I think that's about a week from tomorrow-ish. It's in Hubble, so you won't be able to spread out of it at 7:15 p.m. You can do the formula sheet and calculator like you've done in the past. Any questions on that? I'll give you material coverage in just a second. I will schedule a Q&A session probably the day before, but I haven't done that yet. We've been moving very fast. If you look, it really feels that way if you look at how it corresponds to in the book. We've been looking at light, thin lenses, interference, diffraction, a little bit of how quantum mechanics has come about, quantum mechanics. A lot of this builds on stuff you should know fairly well from chemistry anyway. So hopefully this isn't so new to you. And I hope today to talk a bit about nuclear physics, so not nearly as much as I wish we had time to do. You'll note that as we've been moving quite fast, there are sections in these chapters that we're certainly not covering. I'm not saying anything about how we stress it, that none of those problems have anything to do with any of these necessarily. So I specified the sections that are not being covered. That said, you may find that there'll be some of the stuff that you may not want to do it before the final, but when you get bored, in a week or two after the final, you may want to sit down and read some of this. In particular, I'm probably not going to have enough time to talk about nuclear physics and the way that radiation interacts with matter, including living things. I may talk a little bit about it today, but there's some nice stuff in these chapters that when you look at, you know, if you understand why I'm skipping them for this class, that you may actually have an interest in them. So feel free to read. Okay. I brought, here are all of the exams that haven't been picked up, including the regrades. If you requested a regrade, I did those all this morning and changed grades as appropriately. Okay. And that's all I can think of right at the moment. I need to talk to you about that class. Any questions? Issues? Yes.
How would the final exam be like divided for all the materials?
Okay, so that's a good question. So how will the final exam be distributed amongst the materials? It's cumulative, and I'm going to aim to have about 30% of it being on the new material. So it may end up being 40, it may end up being 20. It just depends on what comes out. It will be about 1.5 times longer than what you're used to, probably not quite twice as long as what you're used to. You have 3 full hours to do it, so you have more than twice the time. At least a few of the problems will be problems, if I can think of good ones, where I try to integrate things from different points in the course. So that I do in the final. Sometimes I don't do so much in a regular midterm. But otherwise, it pretty much is similar. You can see the finals and the halves from the web. Yes?
Do you mean to skip chapter 36?
Yes. That's relativity, and I really wish I could spend one lecture talking to you about it. It's fabulous, but nuclear is more important for you guys, so that's all I'm doing today. That is a chapter which is probably irrelevant for most of you, given where you're headed. Probably irrelevant for the MCATs, but you also might have a whole lot of fun going carefully through chapter 36. It's time and space as you know it, and a grown-up believing that this isn't true. So it's a very neat thing. It's just, I don't have time to do everything. So, okay? All right, so I would like to talk about some. We can't do relativity, but we can do some of your stuff today. Anyway, one thing that I would like to do is to talk about nuclear physics later. I'll do a little bit of quantum mechanics first. But I think seeing things makes you a believer. And so what we have up here is called the cloud chamber. And within this cloud chamber is a needle, and you can see the needle sort of, I hope I didn't blast somebody, you can see the needle sticking out on the TV. As the needle comes out, we actually have an alpha source that is a naturally radioactive nucleus that emits alpha particles, alpha being basically helium nuclei, two protons, two neutrons. Because it has two protons and it's fairly massive, it's very ionizing. It distributes, it deposits a lot of energy. If you happen to have alphas going into a gas that is cooled down just to the point of condensation, then it turns out that the condensation will form around these energy depositions. And so you can actually see the tracks of the alpha particles as they go out. I don't think you can see it terribly well on the TV. If you're close enough, you might be able to see little wisps coming off of this thing and tell. But I think it's really cool to see. So what I would like you to do is I'm going to go ahead and carry on. And I would like you to basically start here and just a handful come up and look at this. And then you sit back down and another handful come up. And et cetera, okay, throughout class, if you would just do that. So what you're going to see is you come and you look, you'll see this thin rod coming out, and if you look at the rod for a moment, you will see little narrow wisps of white mist forming, coming off of this rod. And those are literally tracks from the alpha particles that are decaying from nuclei in the rod. So it's sort of cool. So at any rate, feel free to come on and take a look at it as we go. Don't be shy. It's very cool. Alright, so last time we started talking about quantum mechanics. And in doing so, remember that we interpret the particle as being a wave rather than a dB sort of thing. And when you do that, then we came up, we looked at Schrodinger's equation, which was a wave equation for a strange wave, one that actually has mass. And it turns out that this wave equation has some weird things in it. It has a complex number, actually. Not complex as being difficult, but complex as in using the little square root of minus one I in there. And if you have something that's complex, what does it even mean? Right, physically, it's hard. So it turns out that when you look at wave equations that are in quantum mechanics, what the actual nature of psi is sort of confusing. But people came to interpret psi as being the probability of finding the particle in some region of space. This leads to some very strange things. I started talking about in this class last time. Imagine if I have a photon or an electron passing through a thin slit. It's a wave. So if it's a wave, it's diffractive. It's diffractive. What it means is that you don't get a sharp shadow of this slit. What you get is the wave is diffracted. That is, if I were to look at the intensity of the photons or the electrons that go through, you'll have a peak on a detector here, but it will tail off and there'll be a width here, and that's the diffraction maximum, which I hope you're familiar with by now. So if I have a single photon or a single electron, and I have a granular detector here in this wall, such that I can tell where that single photon or that single electron interacts, then if I have a single one, I really don't know where it's going to go along here. What I know is if I have a billion of them, I will have a distribution in intensity that looks something like this. That's what I know from quantum mechanics. So if I square the wave function for that electron or the photon as it goes through, you know, after it goes through the slit, what I will find is this sort of distribution in probability. And that's all that quantum mechanics gives us. So for a single particle, we don't know where it's going to go. We have no idea, except that I can tell you its most probable place is going to be right here, because that's where the distribution of the square of the wave function is. So that means that if we look at the time evolution of this wave function as the particle proceeds from this point to that point, the mathematics, the wave function itself, has to contain within it this full distribution up until the very moment that the particle interacts. And when the particle interacts, it no longer has some weird probability distribution like this. It has a 100% probability that it interacted wherever it interacted. Okay, so there is an instantaneous change in the mathematical description of the wave function from basically being this extended thing into this single probability peak right at the point. This is called the collapse of the wave function, and it may not bother you quite yet. I'll cast it in a way where I hope it will bother you a bit more. But it basically is instantaneous, which is very bothersome at a fundamental level. You can calculate things this way, but at the core of it, it just seems like it violates something important. Here's a different way of thinking about it, sort of a same type of thing. Let's imagine that I have a particle. There are particles called pions that can decay into two different photons. We haven't really talked about it, but photons have spin. And the orientation of that spin is something that is conserved. It's actually an angular momentum conservation thing. So it turns out that if you're sitting there and you're looking at a pion, which is a subatomic particle, so you can't see it well, but it will decay into a pair of photons. And due to angular momentum conservation, those photons will come off the pion either oriented with their spins like this or their spins like that. And if you go and you look at a billion pion decays, half the time you'll see the photons come off like this, and half the time they'll come off like that. So if you're going to quantum mechanically describe the system, you have to have a mathematical thing that basically says the wave function of this system for the photons is 50% of this plus 50% of that, because that's the probability distribution you have. Now, what's strange is that the mathematical description of this system has to maintain this superposition of 50-50 this and 50-50, you know, 50% this, 50% that, up until the moment that something resolves this ambiguity. And they're tied together. So it turns out these photons can go, you know, 1,000 kilometers this way and 1,000 kilometers that way, and you can detect if they travel and one of them goes 1,000 kilometers that way and you detect it. If you detect it like this, at the moment you detect it, this one has resolved like that. If you detect it like this, this one is going to be like that. So that's what the mathematics tells you. Now, so early on, you know, I tell you that the probability has to be conserved for this diffraction peak or something. It may not seem so weird. Now, it is weird because you have this 50-50 superposition until you make the observation, and when you do, there's an instantaneous collapse in the probability distribution, and what it tells you is 2,000 miles away, you have just determined whatever this one other one is. That is called an entangled quantum state. It's an unresolved superposition up until something happens that forces it to resolve. It's very bizarre. That's what quantum mechanics tells me. People don't like that. Einstein, among others, didn't like this idea. Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen called this something like spooky action in the distance, because basically you have this instantaneous thing. I do this thing over here, and it determines what's over there. And it's instantaneous, at least theoretically, mathematically. That's the way it has to be. So, generally speaking, when you learn quantum mechanics, at least usually, this is sort of swept under the rug a little bit, and you just learn to calculate things because it works. But fundamentally, this is very weird. And it's called the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics, and it really does sort of involve this. People get around it by saying, well, I'm not actually measuring psi, this collapsing thing. I'm just measuring the final effect of it. So it's a little bit of a workaround. So, not to get too carried away, there are other ways to look at this that may hold more water. So, let me give you another example that you've probably heard of. It's called Schrodinger's cat. And I like Schrodinger's cat as an example because it sort of tells you how ludicrous some of this stuff that comes out of quantum mechanics at face value really sort of is. Imagine we construct a box, and within the box we put a cat, and then we set this thing up so that we have a nucleus that has the probability of decaying. It has, say, a 50-50 probability of decaying within an hour. Alright? And then we have a detector that would detect it if it decays, and if the detector detects the decay, it drops a hammer on a vial of poison and kills the cat. Alright? So that's the idea. So if you were to take this system and close the box and describe it quantum mechanically, it becomes a quantum mechanical problem because quantum mechanics governs the decay of the nucleus. If it has a probability of decaying that's 50% over some given time, effectively then what it means is you have a superposition state inside this box where you have effectively the cat both dead and alive. Because quantum mechanically, if you try to describe this system, you have this thing is described as 50% decayed, 50% not decayed. That's the only way you can get the actual right probability distribution in the end. You have to have this in a superposition quantum state. And if that's in a superposition quantum state, then effectively the cat is as well. So what that means is during this period, if you want to think about how to describe the cat's wave function, it's basically half dead and half alive, which is sort of weird. And in principle now, you open the box, you make an observation, and you collapse the wave function, and the cat is either dead or alive. Okay. So this is a little bit bothersome, and it sounds really crazy in part because somehow it doesn't bother you so much that I have these entangled photons. But if I have a cat state that's sort of entangled between dead and alive, that's just a little bit weird. So, okay. But it works. Quantum mechanics works really well. So you can talk about these superposition states and the fact that when you observe it, you sort of cause it to collapse, and you observe whatever. It's bizarre. There's a different way of looking at it, which is interesting enough that I'll mention it. It's much more elegant mathematically, as it turns out, but it leads to some other sort of weird issues. We are in our universe, we take the cat, we put it in the box. As soon as we close this box, we basically have this superposition state. The problem with Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics is you have the superposition persist, and it can involve these weird things that then have to collapse the instant you interact with the wave function. And that collapse has to be instantaneous, which should bother everybody. What we call the mini-worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics, which is basically invented by this guy, Hugh Everett, for his PhD thesis in 1957, It's very different. What he says is you really don't have just the wave function of this nucleus in a cat. You have a wave function of the whole universe. And within this wave function of the whole universe, anything that can happen quantum mechanically does happen quantum mechanically, and this whole wave function evolves appropriately. So what does that really mean? What it means is I make this cat experiment happen, and effectively within the overall wave function of the universe, you have a piece of it where the cat is alive and a piece of it where it is dead. And the overall probability distribution hasn't changed, which means in half the paths you have the cat dead and half the paths you have it alive. But if I integrate total probability, the same thing. So in this way, it's weird in the sense that you don't isolate a little system. You think of this whole evolving wave function happening, and anything that can happen does happen, so you never have anything like a collapsing wave function. But what you have are, within the overall wave function, effectively different threads of reality that you can experience. Even though the others are all there, you're only able to experience the one you're in. That's not quite as crazy as it might sound, because when you do mathematics, you've done calculus where you have n dimensions, right? Well, if you have, you know, if you're in a two-dimensional world, and you go into a grocery store, and there's a mouse on the shelf up above, you don't ever see it, right? So if you separate things dimensionally. So the big wave function is infinite dimensional. So if you basically get separated in different dimensions, such as cat alive dimension versus cat dead dimension, as pieces of the wave function, and you don't necessarily experience things that are sort of dimensionally separated from you. So this is a very strange way to look at things, but mathematically, I actually think it's much more elegant, and it works very well. It leads to little issues like, if you think of these different threads of reality and all the quantum processes that are happening in our universe at a given time, you instantly get infinite numbers of universes. And instead of different threads, you can think of it as being a continuum of realities, because the cat may be dead, the cat may be alive, but that happened at a certain instant, and at that instant, the rest of the universe is all the same, basically. So you have a universe that's sort of separating in terms of your experience, but it only differs in that one little way. And as they diverge, different things happen in the two of them, so they begin to diverge more and more, but it's a very weird sort of thing. Anyway, this is a form of a multiverse idea, which is out there, which is based on science. It is not, you can't experimentally distinguish between it and the Copenhagen interpretation, but it is something you sort of have to take seriously, because quantum mechanics really works. And all we're really talking about is, how are we interpreting the mechanics that goes underneath it? Okay, so that may strike some of you as a little fuzzy. I don't know. There's pieces of it that are not very fuzzy that have very strong implications for your world. And that's the uncertainty principle that comes about when you look at a wave. There's a different way to present this, which will basically tell you this is a product of the fact that you're thinking of the particles as a wave. I'm not going to present that way. I'm going to do it a different way. So that connection may be a little lost to you, but the thing I wanted to bring up is that the fact that you have an uncertainty principle in quantum mechanics isn't something really fabulously new that's with quantum mechanics. It is simply the fact that anything where you have waves, you have certain limitations like this. And if you're interpreting particles as waves or photons as particles, then you're going to end up with uncertainty principles. So what does it really mean? So the way I want to present it to you is, you can think of, for example, the wave nature becomes important for things that are very small, like the electron is very small. So suppose you wanted to take an electron, suppose you wanted to take a car, and you wanted to determine where it is and how fast it's going, or its momentum, simultaneously. Then you could take a laser beam and bounce, you know, pulses of light off the car and measure if the car is moving. You can take a pulse of light, hit it here, and hit it here, measure, you know, the distance between where you see those pulses reflected, how much time elapsed, and you could get a direction, and you could, in principle, get the position of the car at that instant as precisely as you care to do. That's Newtonian physics. That's your use to it. Okay? Now, if you do that for something small, like an electron, if you bounce a photon off an electron, you change its momentum. It's called Compton scattering. If I took a wrecking ball and tried to measure the position of the car with a wrecking ball, it would change the car's momentum, right? That's basically what you're doing when you hit an electron with a photon, is you're zapping it. And so when you look at going to the very small, you can't really measure the position and the momentum both very precisely at the same time. There's a thing called Fourier analysis, which basically says no, I'm not going to jump off that cliff. Sorry. There's a better way of motivating this that basically tells you that this uncertainty principle just comes out of the gating theory. If any of you have had a course in Fourier analysis, this should not be news. So, anyway, but I think it's not worth our time. Let's just say that if we quantify this, it says that the uncertainty in the position times the uncertainty in the momentum together have to be greater than some number. This number is a small number because h is a small constant. That's Planck's constant. So this means I can improve the measurement of where something is, and as I improve that, my knowledge of its momentum becomes less clear. Okay? This form is important in some ways, but it's probably less important than another form which is actually completely equivalent to it, but is more relevant for things that might concern us today and maybe you in the lab, which is I cannot simultaneously to perfect precision determine the energy of a system and the time over which it exists with infinite precision. Another way to say this is if something happens over a short enough time, that is my uncertainty in the time becomes smaller and smaller because it's a very quick thing, my knowledge of the energy of it becomes arbitrarily large. Which a different way of saying is I can effectively break energy conservation if I do it over so short a time, you can never know it. Which may sound ridiculous, and it may seem sort of like you shouldn't have to worry about it, but it has some important consequences. If you are studying spectral lines in your laboratory, so you're doing diagnostics like IR spectrophotometry or UV spectrophotometry, or you're looking at lasers and you're doing a spectrum analysis of something. If the light that you are studying comes from a metastable state that lives for a very short time when it decays, so you excite the atoms, something lives a very short time and then decays down, and is that light that you detect? If that thing lives for a very short time, then your knowledge of the energy of that system, of that state, is not good. Which means when it drops down emitting the light that you see, your knowledge of that frequency of the light is actually uncertain. This can lead to you're trying to do spectroscopy and there's a line that has a width that you cannot reduce because of the quantum mechanical effect of its coming from a state that is short-lived. So experimentally, this is seen and well understood, but it can lead to smearing out the resolution and energy for certain things that you may be looking at in your laboratory diagnostics if you are not, if you happen to be dealing with a state that's short-lived. So there are some very practical effects. I wanted to take a minute to tell you some other effects of this, though. You can imagine, so what does this mean? Remember, quantum mechanics, the wave function has within it all of the different possibilities. That's what you deal with. It's something that's looking at possibilities and probabilities. That's what it's all about. So if you suppose that you have an electron bebopping along the vacuum, if you look at it over a very short period of time, it could just emit a photon, effectively breaking conservation of energy, so long as this time frame is a very short period of time. This will come back. You can never detect this thing because it doesn't exist for very long. And this we call a virtual particle. This photon could pair produce into electron and positron, come back. You could have other processes happen. And if you ask what is the nature of the electron in quantum mechanics, you have to sum up over all of these possibilities that are allowed by the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. You might think you don't care, but there's some weirdness here, because suppose I have an electron here and an electron here, and I don't think of them as BBs, but I think of them as these clouds of virtual particles, which are possibilities that you have opened up because of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. And suppose this one emits a photon, but instead of coming back to this electron, it hits another one. If I look at this electron in this picture, for example, all of these pieces are actually carrying momentum or charge or something like that. So what it is to be an electron becomes sort of diffused out over these virtual particles. Here I would be exchanging a momentum, and that is what we call a force. So in quantum mechanics, the fundamental picture of the electromagnetic force, that is the thing that is different from the electric field and stuff that we've talked about all semester, is that you fundamentally interpret the force as this exchange of these bizarre virtual particles that are allowed by Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. Which I think should sound completely crazy if you've never heard of it before, but it turns out to be the thing that underlies the standard model of particle physics, which really seems to be the theory that works to describe everything. And we have theories that work for electromagnetism, which you're used to. It also works for the nuclear forces, strong and weak. So it seems to be sort of the fundamental nature of forces insofar as we know. You guys okay? All right. It gets worse than that. Because now what do we mean when you talk about a vacuum in the first place? It's empty. Well, if I take a little piece of vacuum and I look at it over a very short time, my knowledge of the energy is really uncertain. The energy could be so uncertain that I could just create a pair of a particle and antiparticle out of nothing. And that is an allowed possibility. If that's an allowed possibility, then you actually have to model the vacuum as a seething sea of particle and antiparticle pairs popping in and out of the vacuum. You think, oh my God, that can't be true. Well, if you look at an electron and you look at the vacuum like this, then you would say, I have these pairs popping out all around it because that's what vacuums do. If I have an electric charge sitting in the middle of that, some of those pairs will orient a little bit because they're in that electric charge, which means you will, on average, with these pairs, have the positron pointing a little bit more toward the electron. It should screen the charge a little bit. And if that happens, then the electric force you should measure should be a little weaker than you would expect it to be otherwise. And in fact, you can go and look at spectra. Remember, spectra are energy levels, changes in going from one shell to another, emitting light, right? If I adjust due to this so-called, we call it vacuum polarization, if I adjust the strength of the Coulomb force a little bit due to this weird effect, it will affect the spectrum. And it turns out if you go and you look in the laboratory, you see this effect on the spectrum. So vacuum polarization isn't something crazy. It's solidly seen in the laboratory and understood to be this quantum effect. So it may seem like a weird way to think of a vacuum, but we have strong experimental evidence supporting this whole idea of vacuum polarization.
Okay? No, it's not going to be on the final. All right. So,
what will be on the final? When we talk about quantum mechanics, please understand the nature of the infinite square well, why you get quantization, how you interpret a wave function, psi square, and then what that means in terms of the atomic model. We're not solving for the atom, okay? But you want to understand what the implications are of solving for Coulomb potential. So that is the atomic, how to fill a multi-electron atom, that kind of stuff. That's some of that general chemistry, so that's partly why I went so fast through it, that I want you to do. Okay, so if you're going to pick up one thing out of nuclear physics, and one of you becomes president, good God, if you're president and I hear you say the word nuclear, I'm going to come and I'll get thrown in jail for trying to kill you. Okay, so we have had two sitting presidents that couldn't pronounce the word, which I don't know about you, but it really has always bothered me. Happily, Obama can't actually pronounce the word nuclear. It is not nuclear. It is nuclear. All together. Nuclear. Look, where I grew up in North Carolina, and there was plenty of people who thought it was nuclear. I also had a sixth grade teacher whose name was Mrs. Kyle. That's how she pronounced it. Mrs. Go figure. All right, never mind. I won't get started on that. So what I'd like to do is to spend a little while talking about some of the basics of nuclear physics. Some of this you know from chemistry. The model of the atom, it's actually a very bizarre model if you stop and look at it. You're very used to it. But I want you to step back and look at what this stupid model is telling us. It's telling us we have some region that's about 10 to the minus 9 meters in size where you have these electron shells that are coming out of quantum mechanics that you're probably pretty familiar with. What's a little bit weird in all this is the nucleus, where you shove almost all the mass and the positive charge and everything, has a size of only 10 to the minus 15 meters. The world is almost all empty space. Okay? So you shove all the mass and everything in this little tiny thing that's a million times smaller. And you think, well, why in the world would I ever believe that happens? And I think I mentioned this earlier. The experiments that show this happened around 1905-ish, 1910-ish. And it was done in Rutherford's lab in England. You take an alpha source, what that is, we'll talk about, and you look at how the alpha particles scatter off of a thin aluminum foil. So you can imagine if you have the positive charge distributed around the nucleus, the scattering will always be small. The classic model of the time is called the plum pudding model. And the model of the atom is I have this diffuse positive, diffuse negative charge, and I have these little positive particles sort of distributed around it. In some, I haven't quite figured out how it works, stable electrostatic sense. And then these things vibrate, and that vibration is quantized in a way that gives you the light of certain frequencies. Okay, so that was sort of the idea. But what was seen experimentally was that most of the time you got these small deflections, which you would expect that this is diffused, but sometimes you got this really whopper deflection, and you can calculate what that means if you're going to deflect this thing via the Coulomb force. If you looked at the distribution and looked at these events where things got deflected, if the model looks like all this negative crap around a very tightly centered nucleus where all the mass is, then most of the time these particles are diffused, are deflected just a little bit or not at all, so not so different from what you'd expect from the Coulomb pudding model. But here, now and then, you have the dart headed right for the target. And when you've got that, this alpha particle gets kicked backwards. And you can actually calculate, infer from the data, what the size and mass of this thing has to be. And that's where the atomic model with the nuclear model at the center came from. There's a real problem with this. What's the problem? I take all my positive charges and I put them 10 to the minus 15 meters apart. Calculate the Coulomb force on that. The nucleus has no business being stable. The Coulomb force that we very well understand should blow it apart. So, therefore, we know there has to exist another force. And it is an attractive force. And it not only seems to work on protons, but on neutrons. So it is not a force that's tied to electric charge. So what you have, if you look at the potential surrounding a nucleus, here would be the center of the nucleus, you would have a strong attractive potential. And underlying that, you would also have the Coulomb potential. If you look at this, this is telling you that this is trying to push you away from the center, and this piece is attracting you in the center. So the potential would look something like this. This would be a very attractive potential. So you basically have, out to about 10 to the minus 15 meters, some force that's holding everything together, and as soon as you get beyond about 10 to the minus 15 meters, then the dominant force is the Coulomb force, which is pushing everything apart. So this nuclear force, experimentally, appears to be very short range. And you can determine that by looking again at how things look when you try to scatter particles off of it. So basically, everything looks Coulomb-like until you reach the edge of the nucleus, and then it goes very much not Coulomb-like immediately. If you keep probing in, it turns out that the nuclear density appears to be approximately constant within the nucleus itself. And you can determine that by looking at how the size of the nucleus varies with the number of nucleons that you add in. So as I look at bigger and bigger nuclei, I can ask what is the radius, and what you find is that it goes as about a to the one-third, which would work for constant density. The density is ridiculous, 10 to the 17 kilograms per meter cubed. The matter density on the inside of the nucleus is such that if the Earth had that density, it would be a ball of about 140 meters in radius. So nuclear matter is very, very dense. Now recall what we've seen in Schrodinger's equation is that if we have something in an attractive potential, you will have bound states that are discrete. Inside the nucleus, we know we have a very strong attractive potential because otherwise the nucleus should blow apart because of the Coulomb repulsion. It doesn't. Therefore, I have a strong binding potential. I have a force that's very attractive. Because of that, if I solve Schrodinger's equation in such a case, I will get bound states and discrete energy states just like you have in an atom. They'll be different because the force is different, the sizes are different, the energies will be different. But you should expect that the protons and neutrons will exist in discrete quantum states inside the nucleus itself, which is in fact what we see. The nucleus contains then protons and neutrons. These are fermions. They have spin 1/2, just like the electron. So as you have these discrete shell structure inside the nucleus in terms of energy, you will fill these shells sort of like you do with the atoms, with the electrons in multi-electron atoms. That is, you'll put a neutron spin up and one spin down in the lowest energy state inside the nucleus. You can also have those
levels which fill with protons. Protons are different particles, so they will fill sort of a parallel set of energies. These energies will differ a little bit because here you have the Coulomb force you have to worry about, so that actually changes the, how the levels are. But the strong nuclear force appears to affect the protons and neutrons. So the thing is, in atoms, if you look at the difference between the orbital energies for atoms, for the electrons in an atom, one important number I think we talked about at the very start of the semester is what sets the scale for that. The lowest energy state in the hydrogen atom is bound by 13.6 electron volts. That's the amount of energy it takes to take that electron in the hydrogen atom and remove it from the atom. 13.6 electron volts. If I have it absorb or emit some light from the level 2, I forget the level 2, but you're going to talk about a difference in energy of electron volts. That sets the scale for chemical interactions. Chemical interactions are rearrangements of atomic electrons. So the energies that are going to happen per thing is going to be an order of electron volts to tens of electron volts. Okay? If you start to look at the same thing inside a nucleus, because this is such a strong attractive potential, the numbers are very different. If you look at a nucleus and you ask, how much energy does it take for me to take a single nucleon out of a nucleus, like a, say, an iron nucleus? So how much does it take to ionize the nucleus, if you want to think of it that way? The answer is on the order of millions of electron volts. So if I rearrange nuclei, the kinds of changes in energy you're talking about are not tens of electron volts, but millions of electron volts. So the unit that we usually deal with is not an EV, but an MeV. And typically, if you look at the mass of particles, and you use something we haven't talked about, this equation comes out of special relativity, where you have an energy-mass equivalence. Basically, it says that mass is nothing more than a different phase of energy. You can talk about mass units being MeV over c squared. So in these units, the mass of the electron is a half of MeV over c squared. And the proton is almost 938 MeV over c squared. Just to give you a bit of a scale, this, if it's 1,000 MeV, it's called 1 GeV, which is a billion electron volts. And the accelerator, the highest energy accelerator we have currently running, is at an energy per particle in the beam of 7 TeV, which is 7,000 GeV. So that's 7,000 billion electron volts. Just because I wanted to spout off a bunch of numbers, I guess. But that gives you some idea of the energy range over which we've been able to explore. Okay, so what does that mean? That means if I take nuclei and I rearrange them, the kinds of energy changes we're talking about on a per bit is not tens of electron volts, but millions of electron volts. So if I take a kilogram of dynamite and I set it off, I get a bang. And if I take a kilogram of uranium and I set it off, I get a kabloop, right? That's the difference. It's really the scale of what's happening on each of those interactions. But if I have these nuclei and they have discrete states and they have certain energies, then you can imagine, just like in atoms, some of them are going to be stable, some are going to be metastable, and some are going to be completely unstable. And you have exactly the same thing in nuclei. So it turns out that nuclei will rearrange if they're in some effect. If they can go to a lower energy state, they'll rearrange. For atoms and molecules, the way you do that is you emit energy or you change vibrational states. The energy changes here are massive. They're so big, they are big on the scale of the mass of things. So an additional way in which they can change is actually emitting particles. not just light, but actual protons or alpha particles or weird things like that. So the world is a bit different. So to talk about nuclei, we talk about, this is their atomic symbol that you're used to, H for hydrogen, He for helium, etc. Z is the number of protons. This is basically the same information, as you know. The elemental character is defined by the number of protons you have in the nucleus. If you look at the Bohr model of the atom, the spectrum, the shell levels that you get are determined entirely by the Z of the nucleus. Doesn't care what the number of neutrons are. It's just that Coulomb attraction to that single part, that single electron, and that what its orbital levels are determined by Z of the nucleus. If you do the full-blown quantum mechanical thing and you're doing the multi-electron atom, basically that is still true. The shell levels you get are determined by the Z of the nucleus. The shell levels and how tightly all the electrons are carried and how many are unpaired and paired, that's chemistry. So what that means is that chemistry really cares about what Z is. And that's why we talk about different chemical elements, and the one-to-one mapping is between element and Z, because Z determines chemistry largely. You have a lot of trouble if you're trying to chemically separate two things that only differ by the number of neutrons. Do you care about that? Do you have any idea what? If you, right, things that have the same Z but different numbers of neutrons are called isotopes. Okay? They're chemically similar. They are different nuclei, so the nuclei can be different characters. Can you tell me anything that's been in the news recently that has anything to do with this? Did somebody read the newspaper?
Uranium enrichment.
Thank you. Yeah. Right now, all the hullabaloo about Iran and their nuclear program simply has to do with uranium enrichment, which I hope I'll have time to talk a little bit about. But in the end, if you want to create a nuclear warhead, you need a certain isotope of uranium because the nucleus has to have certain characteristics. But that amounts to only a small percentage of the natural uranium that's out there. Most of it is a different isotope. So the whole game, if you want to build a bomb, is to somehow isolate the isotope that goes bang from the isotope that doesn't. And you have to reach a certain purity in order to have it become explosive, if you will. And that's the whole game. It's really hard to do this. So the way in which they're doing it, you can do it in a couple of different ways. You can't really chemically do it at all, because the chemistry for the two uraniums is the same. Z hasn't changed. But they are slightly different mass. So one of the things you can do is take your uranium, turn it into sort of a gas or whatever, and put it in a centrifuge. And if the centrifuge is one mega good centrifuge, it's going around, the things that are slightly higher mass will go toward the outsides, right? I mean, you do centrifuges in biology all the time. It's the same thing, except you have to have one whopper of a centrifuge. And so it's hard to make these things. So you can actually track to have that special steel and things like that in order to have it withstand the stresses. So you can also use diffusion. You can make it into some gas, and then basically the lighter element with lighter isotope will diffuse a little faster than the heavier isotope. So you can do that a whole lot of times and eventually purify it. Anyway, so when you write down a nucleus, what's really important is Z. Okay, we'll usually put whatever the nuclear type is here, the symbol, but these have the same information. But A is the total number of nucleons, that is the sum of the protons and the neutrons. So to really know what the nucleus is, you really also have to have A, because that's telling you how many neutrons there are, which would be equal to Z A minus Z. So if you have a nucleus and you have discrete energy states, one thing that can happen is you can have a nucleon in a high energy state that drops down to a lower energy state. So it's an exact analog of what you're used to thinking about with the shells and atoms. in which case you emit a photon, just like you do with the shells and atoms. The thing is, the change in energy is hundreds of keV, millions of electron volts, not tens. So that means that the particle that comes out, the photon, E equals h nu. If I have a million electron volts as E, the frequency is really high. And these particles are known as gamma rays. This is no different from a radio wave. It's just got a very high energy. The particle itself carries more energy. How it interacts in matter is very different. If I have a gamma ray that's got over an MeV in energy, when it hits matter, it actually can turn into an electron and positron pair because the sum of the electron and positron in terms of energy is less than the energy of that photon. That mode of operation for a lower energy photon, like an X-ray or a UV photon or a visible light photon, it's not there. They don't have enough energy to pair produce into particles. But for high energy things, you do. So you do get some weird things that open up as you go up to such high energies. Another type of radiation that is released is basically an electron or its antiparticle, a positron. And when this happens, you're changing the electrical charge of the nucleus. So for example, if you go from this species of nucleus where you have AZ and you increase Z by 1, you don't really change the nuclear mass very much because the electron is very light. But you go from a nucleus of Z to a nucleus of Z plus 1. So you've literally transmuted the type of nucleus when this happens. And the electron comes off. We typically call this beta radiation. There's another particle I won't have time to talk about. It's almost massless. Very interesting particle called the neutrino that I won't talk about in this class. You can have nuclei that generate where Z goes to Z minus 1. That is, it sends out a positive electron, a positron. It also emits a neutrino, which we won't talk about. That's known as beta radiation or beta rays. Beta rays are nothing but electrons or positrons, depending on what kind of thing is emitting them.
In addition, you can have a change in the nucleus where Z changes by 2 and nucleons change by 4. You emit a literally 2-proton-2-neutron combination or a helium nucleus, and that's known as an alpha particle. I'll take a moment to talk about radiation safety before I get into some other stuff.
The particles that are being emitted are very different. How they interact with matter is very different. A photon penetrates through matter, like an X-ray penetrates through matter. Some small fraction of them interact with matter as you go. You can characterize that with something we call radiation length. So radiation length is something that's like lead. Radiation length is short, that is, the photons interact very quickly. If it's a gas, then the radiation length is very long. But the way it's a probabilistic thing, so only a few of them interact as they go. What this means is if I have a beam of gamma rays on my body, it penetrates deeply. And the beam will penetrate, and there will be interactions all along the path. Those interactions are high enough in energy, they can cause biological damage. But most of those photons are probably going to go right through me. But those that interact can be dead. Electrons are very different. If I have a beta source outside my body, it's not very penetrating. Why? Because it's a charged particle. When it hits the skin, if it has a lot of energy, it just ionizes some of the stuff in your skin. That can be bad. That ionization can be on DNA molecules, which can cause problems later on. So it's not a good thing. But it will be stopped by the skin. It's not so different from low-energy photons that can't penetrate in very, very much, so like UV photons. So if you're around the beta source for a bit too long, you're likely to just feel sunburned a bit more than, okay? That's not a good thing. You don't really want it, but that's the danger that's outside your body. Gamma sources are very different because the gammas can go in and damage essential organs. They penetrate.
If you have an alpha source, it's heavy, has two Z's, ionizes more heavily, it's stopped by stuff that's less thick than can stop the beta. So whereas your skin can sort of stop a beta, a thin sheet of paper can stop an alpha. It's easy to shield against them, but they're very ionized. So outside your body, the photon source is most dangerous to you because it can penetrate inside your body. Okay? Now, if you have your radioactive source mixed in water and you're deciding to drink it, you ingest it in some way, the order of danger is reversed. If I drink a gamma source, I'm going to glow gamma rays. But most of them aren't going to stop in me. So I'm not saying it's safe to do that, but I'm saying I'll glow gamma rays. If I drink a beta source, those don't get out of me. All those decays are things that are distributed in my body and can be hurting essential pieces of me. Alpha sources will hurt you more. They're heavily ionizing, so if you're going to cause ripping apart of DNA, it's going to happen more if you're alphas. So an alpha source is more dangerous to ingest. So the nature of what it is you ingest is or have outside is very important. And so the danger that's posed by these things depends on what the source is. In addition, of course, some sources, as we'll talk about in a moment, are very unstable, which means there's lots of particles coming out. If I have a lot of it, I have lots more particles coming out than I have a little of it. If I have a lot of it, but I have it over there, it's less dangerous to me than if it's right here. If I have it right here, but I just walk by quickly, it's not as dangerous as it is if I sit here and work all day. So proximity, the amount, what it is, all of these things are factors that determine how dangerous the radioactive substance is that you're dealing with. And you should get a good handle on all these things if you're doing radioactive labeling or something in the lab. You really don't want to mess around. You want to know what you're doing. And you want to be protected if it's out from you. And you really don't want to ingest it. Because if you ingest it, then you get these other issues. So there's a lot to think about. It can also depend on what it is. If it's a certain type of... because it interacts chemically, right, in your body in a certain way. Your body doesn't care whether it's radioactive iodine or not. It does its thing with iodine. And if that turns out that it concentrates it in your thyroid, so be it. If it happens to be radioactive iodine, then you get to cook the thyroid. But, you know, so there's also the whole biological effect that happens depending on what the actual chemistry of that thing happens to be. So you have to worry about all these effects. One of the most important effects is really how stable is that nucleus, how hot is it, if you want to think about it, how dangerous is that particular radioactive nucleus. And so the way that you can quantify that is here's your substance, and you say, how many decays per second do I see? And what we say is that the decays per second depends on how many nuclei I have. If I have a big pile, I get more decays per second than if I have a small pile. But some nuclei will be more stable than others. So there's a constant of proportionality that we use. And that's called the decay constant. Something that is really unstable, so that I get lots of decays per second for a given number of nuclei, has a large decay constant. If it's a small decay constant, it's fairly stable. So this is the equation that governs the rate of decay of the nuclear stuff that's in front of you. Mathematically, you can solve this. I can pull the N down, the DT over, and integrate both sides. I can ask, if I start out with N0 nuclei in a sample, and I end up with N, you know, how many decays per second do I have? So I can integrate both sides, so I can ask, over time t, how many nuclei do I end up with if I start with N0? So the left-hand side is a natural log of n over n0. The right-hand side is just lambda t. work out the integral. Take the natural log of both sides, that n over n0 is e to the minus lambda t, or n is equal to n0 e to the minus lambda t. That's the operable equation. It's an exponential decay over time. If I start with n0, depending on lambda, the number drops exponentially in time. If lambda is really big, then this is a very fast exponential drop. If lambda is small, it's slow. So the decay constant is really one-to-one with something called the alpha. If I define this and I ask, what happens when I start, if I start with one here and I want to let it drop to half that, how much time does it take? So when you define, when you find time, when this goes from 2 to 1, for example, and you solve for the time, you end up with this equation. So this tells you what the half-life is. So if I have a large lambda, remember large lambda, large decay rate, means very unstable nucleus, then the half-life, this is large, the half-life is short. Half-life tells you how long it takes for a given sample of nuclei to be half that, half of them decay. Okay? If it's really unstable, half-life is very short. If it's very stable, half-life is very long. So there's a relationship here which you'll want to be comfortable with. So you can do some cool things with this. I'll just give you one example. We have an isotope of carbon that's radioactive that you are currently breathing. It's called carbon-14. It decays by beta decay with a half-life of 5,730 years. It is everywhere in your environment, and it is everywhere because it's really produced constantly by particles from the sun and other sources hitting the top of the atmosphere, interacting with the nuclei out there, and create some of this radioactive carbon. Since its half-life is long enough, that carbon gets distributed inside the atmosphere, and since you're living and you like carbon, you'll incorporate it in your carbon. So you glow beta rays from carbon-14 that you have incorporated into your body. When you die, you stop incorporating carbon-14. If you get buried or cremated and your body is then isolated from the standard environment, that carbon-14 is decaying away and you're no longer incorporated anymore. So you can look at things that were once alive and see how much carbon-14 is left and know how long ago it was when they stopped incorporating carbon-14, or when they died, if you will. And this is known as radioactive dating. It's a common type. There are lots of other types, but this is just to give you a sense of how it works. You have a sample, you find its activity. Activity is the decay rate. To be 25% of that living material, how old is the bone? This is the half-life. So after one half-life, the activity is going to drop from 100% down to 50% because you have half of the nuclei gone. After two half-lives, it'll be 25%. You can use that exponential formula if you need to. But basically, that tells if you measure it to be a quarter of that you have in normal living things, then that thing died 11,000 years ago. It's very cool. The decay rate is fast enough that it only works, you know, so far back historically before you start to have things that don't make much sense. But you can calibrate it. You have to calibrate it because the flux of particles from the sun and other things on the top of the atmosphere actually varies. So the percentage of carbon-14 that's in the atmosphere varies a little bit from year to year. So there are ways in which you can calibrate it, but one of the ways in which you can do it is you literally can cut down an old tree and shave away each of the rings, and counting from this year, you can count back all the years, and you can look at the material, because the inner rings are dead.
the amount of carbon-14 in those calibrates the amount of carbon-14 that was in the year, in the atmosphere that year. So you can use these tree ring calibrations to make your carbon-14 dating far more accurate. And you can do some cool stuff. One of the professors who died a couple of years ago here, Harry Gove, actually carbon dated the Child of Turin. He got something in the 15th century if you're interested. Sorry, that was a spoiler. He has a book. Okay. So another important thing about nuclei is depending on the nucleus, just like the atoms, the nucleons are held more or less tight. And you can define that by something which is known as the binding energy. You can think of a lot of ionization energy for an atom or whatever. So nuclear binding energy would be basically, if you look at atomic binding energy, for example, what does that mean? Well, if I take the energy of the electron, which would be just its mass, mc squared would be its energy, the energy of the proton for a hydrogen atom, I subtract out of that the energy, the mass of the hydrogen atom itself in its bound state, then it turns out there's a difference between the energy of these separate parts and the energy of this bound state. And that's what you mean when you talk about ionization energy. Ionization energy, I take a hydrogen atom, I rip the two apart. I have to put in 13.6 eV to do it. In nuclei, we do this. We can do the same calculation. I can take the number of neutrons you have times the energy of a per neutron, the number of protons you have, and so to take this. This would be the total sum of all the energy of the things that go in, and then I can subtract from that the mass of the nucleus, which is made up of these protons and neutrons, and that is then the total energy that binds the nucleus together. That's how much energy I would have to put into the system to blow it apart, as a way to think about it. So it's the energy gain that you get when you add all these protons and neutrons together. If I take that and I subtract it by the number of and divide it by the number of nucleons in the nucleus, I basically get a measure of how hard it is to remove a single nucleon from that nucleus. So a way to think about it is you have a really stable nucleus if the binding energy per nucleon is very high. That is, it's hard for me to remove a nucleon. I have a nucleus that's much less stable if I have a low binding energy holding it together. So if we go and we look at how the binding energy per nucleon varies with the number of nucleons. Remember, this is Z plus A, so it's not Z plus neutrons. It's not quite Z. Then you get a characteristic curve. This curve is very important. What it says is that at small nuclei, I have lower binding energy per nucleon. That is, they're not as stable as they are when I go up to around iron. They're very stable. And as I go down from iron, that is, they get bigger, I get much weaker. This actually should make sense if you think of the nuclear force between nucleons as having a short range of about 10 to the minus 15 meters. If I have a nucleon, another nucleon, another nucleon, this whole thing is well within that range. They're all sort of adding to this force, binding everything together. When the nucleus gets big enough, it's now bigger than the range of the force, and as I add more nucleons in, it's not really reaching the whole nucleus, and the Coulomb repulsion that you get from the additional Z is starting to want to blow it apart. So you're going to have a sweet spot of stability around iron. Less stable as you go much bigger, less stable as you go much smaller. If you take a large nucleus and you rip it into two smaller pieces, okay, you take something here and you rip it into two smaller pieces, you're going from something that has that's unstable into more stable, and you release energy. That's what we call nuclear fission. So that would be what you would do with uranium if you wanted to pull it apart to release energy. Nuclear fusion is where you take two small things that are less stable, and when you put them together, they become more stable. That's the difference between fission and fusion. There's a limit here at around iron. where iron is the most stable nucleus that's out there. Shit. I'm out of energy. I'm out of time. Okay. Lots of cool stuff. I will put some slides up, and you're welcome to look through them and ask questions if you want. Clearly, we're not going to talk about it. Got to stop somewhere. All right, so good luck on the final. I'll talk to you in some detail about how, for a few minutes right at the start of the final, about how the end game works with grades and picking up your exams and all that kind of stuff. Okay?